100 years ago today, work began on the Great Ocean Road, linking Geelong and Warrnambool along the sandstone and limestone cliffs at Victoria's Shipwreck Coast and Surf Coast. The road was built by recently returned World War I servicemen, and once completed became the world's largest war memorial, built in honour of the 60,000 Australians killed in action. Ross Bastian is a Melbourne-based military historian who's written a tourist guide to the Great Ocean Road and built and installed 15 historic plaques along the route. Welcome to breakfast.
Thank you very much, Hamish.
What was this part of Victoria like before the construction of the Great Ocean Road?
Oh, it was an extremely wild, remote part of Victoria, accessible really only by the sea. And there were land routes in, but they were pretty rough, and the old Cobb and Co-type coaches struggled to get into these little settlements where small communities lived.
And how did the idea come about?
I think it was generated for commercial reasons by many of the people who believed there was a future here, and some of the people who wanted to get produce out of these regions and into Melbourne in a fit time to have it on the tables in Melbourne, particularly fishing industry, saw this as an excellent way of moving produce around the area.
And I note that when it was first initiated, it was described by some as a wildcat scheme. What did that mean, and why was it viewed that way?
I think it was pretty wildcat at the time because, one, they didn't have the funding, two, they didn't really have a great plan, and they were just going to have to nut out a route around that terrible terrain because it was really rough. And they really didn't have strong support from the state government. It was there, but it took private enterprise and a man called Hitchcock who actually drove the whole project for the rest of his life.
And really interestingly, this was a very old version of a toll road.
Well, it was. Eventually, it became a toll road as a mechanism for making enough money to keep the men working, because there was not a great deal of money coming from the state government's coffers, and therefore they had to make money by various means, and that might be a raffle, it could have been a film night, and they had to make enough to keep the men working, because people today think, you know, you just send in a big construction team and off you go. Not in those days. You had to bring your little team of men in, they'd work for a while, then they'd go off the job and another team had come in, and you had to raise the money. People won't realise, but many of the houses that you pass on the Great Ocean Road now are on land that was given to the Great Ocean Road Trust to sell during the construction of it. And with that money that they got from those blocks of land, they paid the men.
And when the men were there doing these construction periods, what were the conditions like for them?
For them, it was sort of going back 2 or 3 years, 4 years when they were in the trench lines, where they actually had a pretty rough outdoors. They had a bell tent, which was standard issue in those days, and they lived in a tent city. The tent city would have a mess where they ate. They'd have a piano. They'd have newspapers delivered. They'd had a reasonable life, and they worked a 6 day a week, and they tended to work from dawn to dusk. So they were regulated by the hours of the day that had sunlight.
It's been really interesting to read some of the descriptions of the road when it opened as compared with what it's like today. It's sort of hard to imagine, given, you know, how famous it is now, what it was like back then.
Oh, I think that no one in those days ever thought it would get to the level it is now. I mean, the old diggers would be astounded if they could see it. And the road, of course, was very narrow. It was only one lane wide, so that in the morning you'd raise a flag to indicate you could come from, say, Aries Inlet to Lawn, and in the afternoon they'd raise another flag that said, no, you can't do that, but you can come back if you wish to. So they used it as a one-way strip. But interestingly, there were very few road accidents in those days, but when you see the photos, it was a bit of a bog in winter.
And I suppose it, you know, it's become iconic. Was there a turning point for this road when it went from being this very humble idea to being the thing that it is today?
Yeah, I think you'd have to pick the year 1932 when the road linked up with Apollo Bay and you could actually go the whole distance, because up till that date you had to go part of the way in and then turn around and come back, but then people could push all the way through, and it became a tourist attraction just by that. And so we gradually saw the tourist industry become a significant part of their income, and the fishing industry went into decline, and the timber industry also went into decline, because that had been around for 158 years. And they only stopped logging there in 2008, which is quite recent.
What's it been like trying to figure out the history of the Great Ocean Road? Where did you get the stories of the workers and the conditions? Where did you find this?
Well, the Lorne Historical and Anglesey Historical Societies were very helpful to me. I had a 13-14 year job trying to put the bronze works along the road, and it was not easy. Obstruction from some councils was interesting, but other councils were very good. And I had to work as a team with the people in council and with historians, and eventually we put a story together, because all the records for the Great Ocean Road were destroyed in 1940 when the army took over the store camp area where in Geelong. And I think probably a very vigorous regimental sergeant major burnt the lot, and we lost all records and all personal accounts other than, you know, diaries or personal recollection post the road.
Why do you feel so strongly about the Great Ocean Road? I mean, you must have, I have no idea how many times you've driven it, but it must be a lot by the sound of things.
Yeah, it's been a lot now, but look, I'm like most Victorians. I think I'm very proud of one of our greatest attractions. I've been doing military history bronze plaques around the world for over 30 years now, and when I did Gallipoli in France and the Kokoda Trail, I had to say to myself, well, look, it's time I did something like this back home. And as a boy, I drove the road when it was dirt in sections of it, and I just felt passionately that we needed to record that history. And I think that doing the bronzes along the road where people stop at the 14, 15 sites is a good way of recording the history in a more permanent manner than writing just a book.
Ross Bastian, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Ross Bastian is the author of the historical driver's guide to the Great Ocean Road, and he built and erected 15 bronze plaques along the Great Ocean Road route.